The concept of utopia has been around for about 500 years now. The name alone conjures up a vision of a future world where happiness reigns, people get along with each other, and nobody goes hungry. And those are indeed some of the elements of the world imagined by our guest in this hour. Martin Shainhalls lays out the vision in the book Work, Love, and Learning in Utopia. It is subtitled Equality Reimagined. Martin Shainhalls is a cultural anthropologist. He has taught at Columbia, Johns Hopkins, and the University of Pennsylvania, and is the author of two previous books. Martin, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thanks for having me, Jeffrey.
Some of the bios describe you as a psychological anthropologist. What dimension does that add?
So, as an anthropologist, I look at life in different cultures and contemporary cultures. As a psychological anthropologist, I look at the emotions in different cultures. And one of the things that I wanted to start by stressing is that so many of the times the things that we as very individualistic Americans think are peculiar to our own circumstances and responsible for our own happiness or sadness are things that are shared with other people. So the social conditions of a society can help make us happier, and that's the basic point of my book.
Are emotions universal, do you find? I mean, you have visited and spent a fair amount of time with other cultures then. I mean, do you find a pretty good universality in some of the basics anyway?
Yes, I absolutely do. And I have gone around asking people everywhere from the mountains of southwest China to urban China, India, all over the place, what people would like for an ideal life. And usually the ingredients are basically the same. They say that they'll be happiest if they have good relationships with family and friends and appreciation for what they offer in the way of friendship and kinship and work. And that's something I think we can all relate to.
So tell us about what you attempted to do in this book and why you felt a certain amount of trepidation, even including the term utopia in the title.
So I did feel a lot of trepidation using the word utopia because I know that many people have a negative connotation to that word. For many people, it means something that is dictated from on high, and a kind of fanciful imagining of the way the world could be that in most people's way of thinking of utopia is not something that's not possible. But in fact, it doesn't have to be that way. And the utopia that I describe in my book is one that is a comprehensive change in society, but it's changes that are based on the way society is and changes that are quite feasible, as I show, based on social science research. So the book is not just a kind of sci-fi imagining of things. It lays out very specific and scientifically justified proposals for the way that society should be.
But not to say these are not big steps. And in fact, here's a quote from the book. A first key step is to eradicate hierarchy and inequality altogether. So that's going to surprise a few. So you're saying that the pathway to getting a greater equality is to eliminate hierarchy?
Yes, I am. And that is a big step. Of course, it's a huge step. But one of the things that I want to say is it's not as radical as we might imagine, because what anthropology shows is that we as humans evolved about 200,000 years ago, and we evolved and we survived because we were cooperative and compassionate and egalitarian. We shared everything in a small group. We wouldn't have survived if we didn't do that. And we lived that way for most of human existence, up until roughly 6,000 years ago. That's the first record we seem to have of any kind of hierarchy. And so what that means is we have the capacity to do it. It's not something that is unreal. I know it's hard to believe because we look around at the way society is today, and my students always say, you know, we could never get along. Everyone's living in a dog-eat-dog world, and that is the way the world is today. But it's not the way the world has always been, nor the way that it has to be in the future.
Well, and I should point out to the listeners, too, this is a very broad reaper for you. You take on hierarchies of all types.
I do. I do. And I believe you have to. So many times progressives will talk about equality in the workplace, but they won't talk about equality of gender. Or we talk about school reform, but we don't talk about economic reform. And all of those have to be discussed because hierarchy in all of them reinforces hierarchy in the rest. And if we tackle all of them, it can create a kind of virtuous cycle in which we can feel compassion and egalitarianism for all other humans.
So let's get into some real brass tacks kinds of things here, because I'm sure there are people thinking, well, can you have a hierarchy where you have no leaders? I mean, is that mm-hmm. the same thing? I mean, are we talking about there'll be no leaders to look to for answers, that sort of thing?
There won't be leaders the way that we think of them. You know, although today in a small group, if you got a friendship group, if one of your friends started saying, we're going to go to such and such a movie today, and if we don't, I'll punish you. You know, the concept of leadership that we're used to at a larger scale. If your friend said that to you, you'd say, you're crazy. I don't want to be friends with you anymore. In other words, the point is, in a small group, we don't accept coercive kind of leadership. We accept someone who persuades other people and does it in a collegial way. And that's, in fact, the way that leadership has taken place in human societies for most of our history, still occurs today.
So some level of expertise or at least ability to persuade other people that there is an expertise or good reason to do the things that this person is asking us to do.
Persuasion, but not coercion.
Okay. Martin Shane Hall's our guest on The Exchange. His book is Work, Love, and Learning in Utopia. The subtitle is Equality Reimagined. We're talking about a very different world where there is no hierarchy. Equality is a fact. People don't go hungry. People don't suffer for lack of health care. There's a lot to pick up yet as we go through the conversation with Martin. You can join it by phone and email. We're back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is the cultural anthropologist Martin Shane Halls, who envisions a very different world from the one we have now, where there's a great, great amount of equality, no hierarchy whatsoever. He describes this in his book, Work, Love, and Learning in Utopia, subtitled Equality Reimagined. You can join us on the Exchange. You have many thoughts about this, probably. 800-838-3760 on the phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So, Martin, you talk about placing pleasure and happiness above all. So we're not talking about measuring happiness by gross domestic product and things like that anymore.
That's something that already is happening, by the way. At the United Nations, there are some economists who have said that we should measure the well-being of a society not just based upon how much it produces, but also on healthcare, education, and how long people live. And so it's really not that radical. It's also very intuitive that we should measure societies by something other than just how much they produce, because we all want to be happy. And why not acknowledge that by measuring a society based upon happiness and pleasure?
You point out in the book that you come from more of a left-wing kind of position, but it sounds like you take fire from all sides.
I do. I give fire to all sides. One of the things that has always bothered me about many people on the left is that they will talk about equality and they'll talk about rearranging work, but they never talk about the joy that work can and should give. And I think there's something about the puritanical tradition in American culture that affects and influences even those on the left, because we think that somehow talking about the pleasure of work is denigrating work and is talking about something that the Puritans thought pleasure was evil and problematic. And it shouldn't be that way. And we all know that we want to feel pleasure and joy And why not feel it at work above all?
So let me bring in the phrase first world problems, because, you know, we have a cushy lifestyle compared to the rest of the world here. But so is it possible, I'm asking, for people all over the world to get to the places you suggest where they're finding joy in their work and joy in their school?
Yes, absolutely. There is a discourse among economists that says, you know, we live in scarcity and there aren't enough things to go around. And that's false. That's just among some economists. And in reality, one of the things that I document really carefully in the book is that the world can produce more than enough food for all people. And the same is true for all of the other basics of subsistence. And the kind of deprivation and immiseration that happens in third world countries and also even in first world countries is totally unnecessary. There's more than enough food to go around. And as we automate things, there will be less and less work to do and more time for people to be able to create and pursue their own creative inclinations. So why not take advantage of that? Why should we live in a world where there's enough for everyone, but people have to go hungry? It makes no sense. And it's counter to any kind of sense of human rights.
So there's a good point that you bring up about if we achieve utopia, how do we maintain hope? What do we hope for if things are so good already?
Yeah, that's something that I thought about a lot, because I don't want to think of utopia as being a kind of place where it's a steady state and there are no changes and we're just living in some kind of almost boring bliss. Today, we often hope for things that are very difficult for us to have agency in making happen. So we hope for a good job, but it's often not up to us. We hope for love, recognition, and so much of it is out of our control. And what I'm suggesting is that there's a difference between that kind of hope, which is often has a shadow of despair to it, and hope in utopia, in which we will have an agency. We'll have the ability to bring happiness to ourselves and others. My utopia is not anti-work by any means. We will be creating, and then we'll be doing it for other people. The only difference, and I shouldn't say the only difference, because it's a huge difference, is we'll do it for the pleasure that it brings to ourselves and to other people, rather than for the feeling of hierarchy that it gives us to produce something and earn money.
Martin Shainhall is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a cultural anthropologist. He's the author of Work, Love, and Learning in Utopia, subtitled Equality Reimagined. We have a couple of calls already. Let's go to Donovan in Humboldt County. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sure.
So my comment was about this idea of egalitarianism, or question, I guess. I'm wondering how exactly this would work, and so I thought of a little example. And you talked about the movie thing, that, you know, somebody tries to force away, you're going to get them out of your group. So here's an example that might apply. Say you have a small community of, say, 10 or 12 families, and they need power, right? So somebody's an electrical engineer and says, all right, well, you know, I got these solar panels, this idea for a solar panel system and a battery array that we're going to build, and we need to get a shipping container and build all these batteries and blah, blah, blah for the community. And 9 of the 10 families, well, that's a great idea. You know, we're going to kick in our resources and yada, yada. But one family is all like, well, you know, we already have solar panels and we don't want in on this and we're not going to contribute. And so then there's this sticking point where, you know, one family's resisting and the rest of them are into it. And so how do you resolve that? I mean, is this going to be a democracy?
All right. That's a good question about how conflicts are resolved in the utopia you imagine, Martin. Thanks for that question, Donovan.
Yeah, thanks for that question. It's something that I talk about in a whole chapter, how conflict will be resolved. You know, today, conflicts like that can lead to hierarchy or all kinds of divisions. They kind of pierce through the solidarity that we feel in small groups. But in utopia, the conflict resolution will be carried out by trained judges who aren't paid, who aren't compensated, and who don't get special status for what they're doing. And Most importantly, the kinds of resolutions that they will seek will often be non-zero-sum resolutions. So today, so much of our legal system is geared toward paying one side or the other money and or punishing the other side in a winning and losing battle. And that leads to a kind of notion that if you are in a conflict, you have to win, because otherwise you're going to lose out on something. In my utopia, the judges will aim to create a situation in which the people can come to some kind of accommodation in which everyone's ideas feel reflected. So in the example that you cite, I wouldn't necessarily coerce everyone to do the same thing. There's no way that we should ever do that. We could allow some people to try one kind of an energy experiment and other people to try others. And if people want to join a group of people who are doing one experiment, they can. And if they want to do something on their own, they can do that too. I think that it's really important to have people doing a lot of different things and trying a lot of different experiments. And to return to a time in which we try to persuade each other to join us in a certain experiment, rather than coercing each other to join us in doing something.
Martin Shane Hall's again our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Work, Love, and Learning in Utopia, Equality Reimagined. We have a couple phone lines open and email box wide open as well if you'd like to join the conversation on the Exchange about a society where there is no hierarchy. There is equality, just equality, and everybody's needs are taken care of as well. Do you think this can work and how? 800-838-3760 by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange.
Jeff, I am going to, believe it or not, channel my inner Tony from Talent today.
Go ahead with the British accent.
Okay, without the British accent. First of all, I do want to say I'm loving this conversation, but I have one simple question. Why do all utopian experiments fail? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you for that, Paul. Appreciate it.
My answer to that is, I don't think we've really had a genuine utopian experiment. I do my research in China, and I know maybe the caller might say that Chinese communism is a utopian experiment and that it's failed, although even that we could well debate, given China being in the news, and rightly so, for its productivity over the last decade or so. But We've really never had a kind of experiment, partly because we don't talk about the ways that society could be genuinely different. And that's one of the things that I want to change with this conversation. We don't have to accept the world the way that it is. It can be different, and we can imagine a different world that is not fanciful, but one that is based upon social science and our knowledge from biology of the way we as humans act as animals.
So I want to be clear here. Are you holding China up as an example? I mean, because there's a lot of hierarchy there for sure.
Yeah, not at all. China is by no means, there's lots of hierarchy, right. They never actually have been egalitarian by any means. And it's just a fiction, a kind of figure of speech that they ever talked about equality. And that's often true of dictatorial societies. So I'm talking about real equality in all domains, not lip service equality.
So let's talk about what you want here. Utopia should, one, minimize hierarchy, we've talked about. Two, guarantee food, housing, health care, and clothing. Three, change the nature of work. Four, change the nature of school. Five, eliminate non-monetary hierarchies. And let me pause here on number six, challenge inequalities of love as well as of wealth. How would that work?
Well, you know, this is something that I said partially to be provocative, but I think it needs to be said. We talk about equality of money on the left, and that's really, really important. But we don't think that equality of attention and love is anything that we can interfere with. And I don't think that's the case. We all need equality of basic resources, but we all need to be attended to. And the way that the society works today, it channels the inequality that exists in the workplace, in the sphere of love and attention. We have a kind of celebrity culture where a few people get all of the attention, and most people get not enough attention and not enough, you know, basic love and recognition in a larger sense. And it doesn't have to be that way. I always like to think about the show America's Got Talent. There are so many people who go on there who've never been recognized before, who are really, really good. And what that says is that we all have things that can be recognized. And society, the way it's constructed today, only recognizes a few people and ignores the talents of huge numbers of us. And I want to change that by having a media that specifically pays attention to those who have been neglected and focuses on the lives of common people, not those who are celebrities or politicians, or not exclusively on those who are politicians or celebrities.
So then the idea that people rise to the top because they're better at something, that would not be the attention that would be received in the media you envision in Utopia.
Yes, that's right. I mean, and I think we all also know at an intuitive level that so often people who are deemed to be the best really aren't necessarily the best at things. Or sometimes people are really good get overlooked. The example I like for those who are classical musicians, Johann Sebastian Bach is now considered perhaps the greatest or second greatest composer of all time. And yet, after his period of composition for quite a long time, until the early 19th century, he was basically ignored and downplayed until he was rediscovered. And what that says is, here's a person who's really incredibly prolific and profound, and yet he was ignored. There are way too many people, and I'm sure any listener knows that, and many of the listeners may feel that way themselves, having something to offer and having no one to listen to or appreciate that offering.
Let's bring in another call here. We're talking to Martin Shainhalls about his book, Work, Love, and Learning in Utopia, Equality Reimagined. Here's a call from Skeeter in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hiya.
Hi.
Great show. Thank you. I have four quick suggestions on how we might get back to where we were a couple of 100,000 years ago. Thank you so much for your comments, by the way. I'd like to suggest that we human beings on this planet stop thinking of ourselves in nationalistic terms. Instead of calling ourselves Americans first, how about if we think of ourselves as Earthlings first? All of us creatures on the planet, we're all here together. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be really helpful if we started having fewer children. I think that the whole population bomb thing is real, and that we really ought to think about having fewer children. The planet just cannot take us digging into it the way we are. Another suggestion would be for us to listen more. I should stop talking so much and listen more. I'll try to do that. And then the last one is that I really think that it's useful for us to consider using consensus decision-making. Sit in a circle, listen to each other, find common values, really think about the problems and find an answer that all of us can feel pretty good about. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Skeeter. Appreciate that. Martin, it sounds like he's already read your book.
I think he has, and he's right on about everything he said. And lots of things I could say. I'm just going to pick out a couple of them to emphasize. So the idea of thinking of ourselves as Earthlings and not as Americans is really important. The nation state and the idea that we create these boundaries that are policed and enforced is something that's extremely destructive. It's also something really new. I didn't know this until I started doing research on it, but the passport was only invented in the 20th century. The idea that there be a document that keeps you in to certain places and out of other places. And of course, the 20th century was one of the most, if not the most horrific century in human history, with World War I, World War II, the genocides, the Holocaust, and many other genocides. And those are directly related to nationalism and the nation state. And so in my utopia, I propose getting rid of the kinds of boundaries that separate one group of people from other people. And it's very possible to do that if the nature of work changes, because one of the things that makes us create those boundaries is the fear that someone else will take our economic well-being and our jobs. And if basic subsistence is provided to all people, we don't have that fear. I, of course, love the idea of consensus, and it's something I thought about a great deal in the book. And I've thought a lot about that when I've been in groups and looked at the ways that consensus sometimes works and sometimes doesn't. And, of course, one of the things that gets in the way is people's egos and their desire for status.
Yes. Well, okay, we'll get to this exactly where I want to come to when we come back from the break, because questions about the people who actually find some joy in hierarchy. We'll come back and talk more with Martin Shainhalls. His book is Work, Love, and Learning in Utopia, Equality Reimagined. You can join the conversation on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Martin Shainhalls and you in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to the cultural anthropologist Martin Shainhalls about his vision for a world very different from ours. It is, in fact, utopia. He included the title with some reluctance, perhaps, but he imagines a world where there is no hierarchy and there is great equality and our needs are taken care of in terms of food, housing, healthcare, and clothing. Those are guaranteed. His book is called Work, Love, and Learning in Utopia, subtitled Equality Reimagined. You can join the conversation on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Martin, we were talking about people's egos getting in the way, which brings us to one of the major points you make about hierarchy. You say it's antagonistic to joy, but obviously some people get joy from hierarchy, and I'm guessing they're the ones who sit atop the hierarchy. So how do you, in a system, how do you rein in egos when people think that working a little harder, striving a little more, stomping on other people gets them to the top of a food chain?
Yeah, so first of all, I want to take issue slightly with the idea that people find joy in hierarchy. They find a sense of security, but not necessarily joy, although they might experience it as happiness and call it happiness. Partly that's a justification. I cite work done on chimpanzees in which it wasn't until chimpanzees were put in a kind of unnatural environment, studied by Jane Goodall, that they had hierarchy, and the chimps who tried to become the despotic leaders were the ones who were most insecure. And I always think that's interesting and a metaphor for what happens in humans. All we have to do is look around at the people who are most kind of boastful and arrogant and despotic as leaders, and they're often people with the greatest sense of insecurity. And one of the things I also show in the book is that there's a biological basis for that, that oftentimes among animals, all kinds of mammals, the ones who are the highest feel a great deal of anxiety and a great deal of emotional uncertainty. You know, we can see this if you look at the way that people pursue hierarchy and money. It really is like an addiction. It fits the classic notion of addiction, and that people don't feel satisfied with the amount of money and power that they have, and they keep needing more and more. And that's exactly what happens with an addiction, the desire for more and more. And the other component of an addiction that it fits is that the pursuit of more and more comes at the expense of one's regard for one's own well-being and the well-being of those around one. And that's the other part of an addiction that's so destructive and that fits hierarchy precisely. So I like to think, and if we had more time, I'd give more data to support it, but that hierarchy really is an addiction in which people pursue it, but without necessarily feeling full pleasure in it. And we know that's true from the way that people act. They're never satisfied with enough money.
Maybe
they need more.
Well, so maybe if the bursts of energy that people need to express aren't so much about putting themselves in a position of security by moving up a hierarchy. But for example, I just imagine driven artists, you know, people who mm-hmm. need to create. I mean, does Utopia have a space for them?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And more of a space than we have now, because all of the artists and musicians, I'm a musician, and so I know lots of other musicians. What we most desire is to have an audience for our creativity, for our performances, and have that audience be responding to us, not always positively, but responding with kind of compassionate feedback. And in my utopia, the way that I talk about work is that there will always be an audience for people. So many of the things we do creations or the lone scientist in the laboratory without interaction with other people. And it makes for very sterile creations and not good science. One of my friends is a really good scientist, says he needs an audience of people to talk to test out his ideas. And I think that's true for most of us. And so I called it interactive joy, the joy that comes from interaction. So it's not a kind of selfish self-indulgence. It's creativity that contributes to other people's happiness as well.
Let's take another call here. We have Howard in Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Martin Shainhalls, the author of Work, Love, and Learning in Utopia.
Yeah. I was wondering how people with learning disabilities and neurological disabilities would fit into the overall utopian idea that Mr. Shainhalls is presenting, because a lot of these people with learning disabilities and neurological disabilities are not able to contribute because the disabilities won't allow them to, and in many cases it's the overall society would have to adapt itself to them rather than the other usual way about. So I wonder how that would work in including people with learning disabilities, even physical disabilities, in the overall utopian society.
All right, excellent question, Howard. Thanks for that.
Yeah, great question. So I think one of the things that is so profoundly unkind about our current society is that we measure people's worth by what it is that they can contribute under obligation to us. And if they don't contribute, then we threaten their well-being by saying, well, you may not have enough food to eat. You may not have enough money to live. My society does away with that whole dynamic by saying we will all be guaranteed a basic subsistence, a reasonable subsistence, not just minimal food, but good meals and good housing. And our ability to contribute will be our own and our own decision rather than someone else's compulsion upon us. And for people who have various disabilities that impede their ability to contribute, they won't be compelled they won't be shamed as they so often are today for their disability and for their lack of quote-unquote a contribution.
We've been talking generally on a societal level. Let's talk on a more interpersonal level, because you envision things changing there as well, the breaking mm-hmm. up of gender hierarchies, egalitarian
yeah.
sexuality. I mean, mm-hmm. just a general question here first. It's clear people would have to think differently in utopia. I mean, could this be accomplished in a single generation? Do you think it's a few centuries worth of work? What's your timeline there?
Something in between, maybe not one generation, although I think change can happen much more quickly than we often think. And in the realm of gender and sexuality, one of the things I'm saying is first that the kinds of divisions that we make between males and females and the ranking, of course, that happens are really toxic for so many people. The idea of proving that you're a man, the idea of proving that you're a woman worthy of attention, those are extremely hierarchical features, and they're features that damage so many people and lead to so many of the destructive cycles of people looking for someone who can somehow affirm their well-being. And what I want to do is to have a kind of compassionate love and sexuality in which it's the compassionate person, the nice person who receives the most attention, and perhaps in some ways also the neglected person, so that there's attention given to all humans, because there really should be. And I know I'm not the first person to say it. It's a part of major religions, the belief in the integrity of every human. I just am thinking of some of the ways that we can make that happen in the most meaningful parts of our lives.
Well, now that you mention religion, it brings up an email from Becca in Lane County who says, don't you think that most religions started with the idea of achieving utopia? It seems to me that humans are locked into behaviors determined by our DNA. Maybe in a few thousand years we may evolve if we survive. This from Becca in Lane County.
Yeah. So her observation is one that's a reasonable observation, but it's not really correct. It's not locked into our DNA. And my point in talking about us from 200,000 years ago up until 6,000 years ago is to say that what's in our DNA, what's in our capacity, is a desire to be egalitarian. And the way that we are today is the real anomaly. So we really do have that capacity. I'm not saying we should go back to 200,000 years ago, but what I'm saying is that we should realize the potential that we have. And even today, you can see among a lot of times people do some really amazingly small and kind acts that go unnoticed. So even in our hierarchical, supposedly dog-eat-dog world, we don't pay enough attention to those small acts of kindness that often happen.
Another call here from Brian in Williams. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Martin Shainhalls.
All right, thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I love your show, Jeff.
Thank you.
And thanks for the show. I'm coming in a little bit late, so I don't know. Did you guys talk about Ecotopia, that book, Colin Beck's book?
No, not specifically.
Okay, so he's got this thing relative to the hierarchy dilemma you all were talking about,
mm-hmm.
where in the modern day, during Obamacare, Obama talked about the players at the table, meaning big pharma and having to take care of them. That's why we have Obamacare. Looking like it looks like today. So in Colin Back's idea, like to be able to build, you would have to go out and work at a forestry camp for a while, to be able to get wood. And it's kind of related to perhaps allowing people in power with money and living in luxury to be able to live in some sort of agricultural love camp where they're out in nature and living collectively in community. I think that could be a possible solution.
So some kind of service, you're saying? Some sort of...
some kind of service to allow the folks that are used to having those, all those dopamine hits, all that amazing, fabulous luxury, and, very self-contained lives of leisure to, allow that to happen, but, in the natural world together, with guides and teachers and a program to fit into.
All right. Thanks for the idea, Brian. Appreciate that. The reference is to Ecotopia by Ernest Kallenbach. And what do you think, Martin?
Yeah, I think it's a good idea. I think that the basics that we all need to survive, like the production of food, we should all take part in. There's no reason that a small number of people should do the work of farming. And by the way, earn less and less, so little in some cases that people have to go into debt to be farmers, so that the rest of us can live lives of absolute luxury. We can live a luxurious life, but I think that all of us should take part in food production as we are capable of doing and as we are willing to do. And that's also something that's really important, because I think food production has been denigrated, or anything having to do with the use of the hands and the soil and nature has, in most societies, China where I work, that's the lowest status position is being a farmer, and it shouldn't be. It should be something that all of us have the privilege to enjoy. And so in my utopia, everyone will do, if they are capable of doing so, a small number of hours per month on helping to produce food or other basic subsistence needs.
So one of the major things I haven't asked about here, because we've definitely delved into the psychological, social aspects of things, the look of utopia with a vision of so much about society changing, I have to believe that the material and physical culture would be very different as well.
I think so, in some ways. I think that one of the ways that we can deal with the fact, perhaps, I started thinking, you know, well, what if everyone wants to live at a certain beach location? Well, we can't all do that, but we can do it through a lottery or give everyone an equal chance to share in that. I know that won't make everyone happy. Some people will think that only if they get a beach house should they be able to enjoy it, but I don't think that has to be the case. I don't see utopia, though, as I've suggested, as making everyone conform, so people could build different sorts of houses within the basic subsistence. They wouldn't all eat the same food. There's no reason that that has to happen. We can provide different kinds of foods to everyone as long as we provide sufficient amounts of food and housing and the other necessities of life.
So, just a few seconds left here, Martin. What happens to the concepts like and want? I mean, we don't want to hang out with the younger kids right now. We don't want to play that game.
Well, part of what drives that today is kind of the ways that we create exclusions. We don't want to hang out with other people who we think debase us in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And in a non-hierarchical society, that changes. That's a kind of short answer to a tricky question.
I know. I apologize for dropping a two-minute bomb in 15 seconds, but you did it well. Martin Shane Hall's our guest. He's a cultural anthropologist. His book is Work, Love, and Learning in Utopia. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jeffrey.